We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is hour two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson, and at the controls this hour is Jason Croft, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Just a couple of days from now, people around the world will be observing World Population Day. That's actually on the 11th. And it is a day set aside to get people to think about the issue of population, looking ahead to the end of October. And October 31st of this year, it is estimated that the world population will reach 7 billion people. Now, that connects with the topic that we're talking about here this morning in a very important way. As the population of the world increases, so does the demand for food. At the same time, though, as a population has grown, there are some people who worry that science may have pushed yields of basic food crops about as far as they can go, although I'm sure there are people who think there is potential to go further. There's also concern that climate change, rising global temperatures, the possibility of drought, longer and more severe drought, that those things also affect yield and the ability of farmers to feed people. So the question we're trying to take a look at this morning is, what will climate change mean for the ability of farmers to feed a hungry world? And to talk about that subject this morning, here in the studio with us, we have Steve Long. He is the Gutzel University Endowed Professor in Plant Biology and Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. He is also the founder and chief editor of Global Change Biology. That's a journal that looks at issues like biodiversity and conservation. He initiated and directed a study that we'll be talking about here that's been done here in Champaign-Urbana on the experimental farm of the U of I, taking a look at CO2 and what might be the effects of higher carbon dioxide levels on crops, things that we rely on for food, like soybeans and corn. He's also deputy director of the UC Berkeley, University of Illinois Energy Bioscience Institute, and has been doing some work on the possibility that a particular plant that we don't eat could be a source of biofuel, and that maybe would be a better approach than using some of the things that we use as feedstocks to produce liquid transportation fuel. So we'll try to talk a little bit about all of these things, and questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can send us your question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Whatever way you want to do it, you can certainly join the conversation. We just ask people to try to be brief. Be on target for us. That'll help. But questions and comments are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me just maybe ask a basic question. I'm hoping that you can maybe talk about this a little bit. If you look at increases in agricultural productivity that we've seen, maybe, I don't know if it's too big a time frame, but, you know, say like 100 years, say like what's happened over the 20th century. If you look at productivity, I think one of the things that is true is that there's been a very significant increase over that time. Can you put some numbers on that? I mean, can you talk a little bit about how it has increased, roughly speaking, over that time?
Roughly, if we look at the major sort of grains, corn, wheat, rice, soy, then we're talking about a threefold increase over the last century.
Three times.
And particularly rapid increase following the Green Revolution, where we were seeing roughly 30% increase in yield per unit, if you like, per acre, every decade. But as we've seen in the last decade, we appear to be running out of steam with that. Wheat, for example, globally, from the Food and Agricultural Organization numbers, has not increased over the last decade. Rice has barely increased.
Even though perhaps the pace of the increase started to slow, basically up until we were doing pretty well up until about 2000, and then once we got past that point, then we really started to see. The technology that we had, that we'd kind of hit the wall in terms of continuing to bump that up.
Yes, at least the approach, if you like, the techniques that we used in the Green Revolution appear to be running out of steam.
Mm. So, well, basically, what were those techniques? What made that possible?
Well, particularly with rice and wheat, and to some extent corn, dwarfing of the plant. Selecting for a different arrangement of leaves, particularly selecting for a much higher proportion of the plant to actually be invested into the grain. So a number of these, in fact, the total amount of mass we produce per acre has not increased, but the proportion that we put into the grain has. Mm-hmm. And really with rice and wheat, we're now at about 60%. So unless we can grow plants without stems and roots, we're kind of beginning to run out of opportunities there.
Well, here I think that that's interesting because I think there would be people who would have thought that these increases in productivity had a lot to do with inputs. That is, perhaps increased use of fertilizer and possibly also other things that will attack your pests. And while I suppose that also happened, were genetic modifications to the plants to make them more productive, was that actually more important than the other thing?
Well, yes, you're correct about nitrogen, and this is part of the dwarfing, that the older cultivars, when given nitrogen, would, for example, easily fall over in the wind. Oh, the shorter ones could then resist that situation, and yes, nitrogen certainly, of course, as we're getting more grain, we need nitrogen to support that as well.
Mm-hmm. So then I suppose at some point here the question becomes through breeding, and now, of course, we have more sophisticated ways to do that than plant breeders have had in the past. How much more, do you really get to a point where you say you've made the plant as productive as you're going to make it and there's just no further that you're going to push it?
Well, if we look at sort of what we call genetic potential, this is what a cultivar of a crop can do under optimum conditions without disease, without stress, then we appear to have really run out of steam with harvest index. There may be a little bit more we can get there, but the proportion of the plant that ends up in the grain is perhaps almost reaching a biological limit. Another factor is the amount of radiation the plant captures. After planting, how quickly does it cover the ground and capture the sunlight that it's going to use to produce? And we can see, for example, with our best soybean cultivars here, they're now approaching 90% capture of the radiation over the growing season. Mm-hmm. So again, there's not a lot more we can do there in terms of genetic potential. The one area where we do see an opportunity is the efficiency with which the plant converts that intercepted sunlight energy into food, if you like. And we know there that the plant is some way below the theoretical limit. But that has proved conventional breeding has struggled to improve that very much. But we do see opportunities with a genetic engineering for improving that.
Mm-hmm. Just this, I don't know if this is then getting into another area, but in addition to trying to improve the productivity of the crops themselves, the plants themselves, I imagine some people say, well, we're also going to have to bring more acres into production, that land that is currently not farmed. We're just going to have to increase the amount of land we're farming.
There is certainly some potential to do that. Of course, the food crops are probably the most demanding on soil fertility. Mm-hmm. So we do have the Conservation Reserve Program land, which was originally taken out of production really to to essentially support price of crops. Although, more of course, as the name implies, it's also taking out more vulnerable land, land which could be easily eroded when you grow this type of crop. Mm-hmm. So there is some potential to expand the land area, but not a great deal of potential for our food crops. So really increasing the amount we produce per acre is perhaps going to be key to this.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Steve Long. He is professor of crop sciences here at University of Illinois. We're talking about the global food system and climate pressures, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'll tell you what, we have a caller here, and rather than make them wait, we'll go ahead and bring him into the conversation on our toll free line in Piatone, line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning, David. Good morning, guest. How are you guys today?
Good.
Thank you.
You know, my father-in-law is very paranoid about any kind of genetic stuff, and I've been reading up on it. But a lot of people have a lot of concern about any kind of genetic alterations to the food chain. And because wheat, you know, there's no studies out there what long-term effects it might have. I know there's concerns on my part. And I do realize you're trying to prevent crops from going to the wayside because of bugs, infestation, and, you know, diseases and whatnot. But how far do you take it? How far do you take the study before you release it? Is it, you know, maybe 8, 10, 12 years, or is it 5 years? Because my concern is over the safety for people.
Well, I guess there are certainly two sides to this issue. One is, of course, that for 300 years, in some cases longer, we have been altering the genetics of our crops. So by continually crossing them with others, transferring in many genes from other plants, that is, of course, how we've come from, you know, half a ton of grain per hectare to maybe 10 tons today. That's been a very key part of that. But I think perhaps the concern you're expressing is what is called today genetic engineering, where we may be taking genes from bacteria, for example, and putting them into plants. You know, the best example of this, of course, is the BT corn, which is now about 80% of the corn crop. Unfortunately, a lot of misunderstandings have developed in this area. This is actually a really precise technology where we know exactly what genetic change we've made to the plant. We know the code of the gene. We know the protein it produces. So this is the most precise genetic changes we've really ever made in our history. If we look at what we've done in the past, where we've just crossed two plants, in many cases, we have no idea really what all the genes are that we've introduced, what their effects may be. And of course, many of our crops do produce proteins, chemicals which do affect us. I mean, very well-known example is potato, which produces solanine, which is a toxic alkaloid. But I'd really argue almost the opposite way. If you make one of these transformations, the regulatory requirements are very onerous. It typically costs about $500 million to take one of these events to market. Yet I could make a cross in my laboratory between a wheat and a barley plant, produce a new line, and I can introduce that without all of these regulations. So my own opinion is that we're over-regulating genetic engineering. We now have enough experience of, for example, BT, to know that actually there are a lot of environmental advantages of it. We're using far less toxic sprays on our crops than we were in the past. We are getting a definite yield boost in corn beyond really what we thought we'd obtain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as the caller suggests, I think there's been some concern about some particular genetic modifications. And one is the one you mentioned, that where you have the corn that it produces its own pesticide.
Yes.
And then the other big thing I think people are concerned about are those plants that have been engineered to be resistant to common herbicides so that you can essentially spray your whole field. The weeds will die, but your corn and soybeans won't. And I think there people have concerns about, well, does that make some kind of alteration in the plant that might make it potentially hazardous? The kinds of things that we were talking about, say, an alteration in a plant that just makes it shorter or that makes it put out more foliage or that possibly – and we'll talk about people are concerned with breeding plants that would make them resistant to higher temperatures, more drought tolerant, and on the other side of that, more tolerant to being have your field flooded. I mean, is that really is the kind of level of change in the plant that you're introducing as dramatic as if you either bred it for to have this pesticide component in it, or you bred it so that it would not die if you sprayed it with Roundup? I mean, is that really an equivalent kind of thing?
I think, you know, if we take the case of – well, take the case of BT, first of all, the BT corn, which is resistant to a number of insect pests, then particularly the rootworm, which is can be quite devastating to corn. I'd say from conventional breeding techniques, we've never seen anything really as successful as this. It has – in the case of corn, it has given us a major yield jump. Some would argue that if we look at our major crops, wheat and rice, wheat particular is really not showing increases in yield. Corn is the one which is maintaining these increases year on year. And certainly these transgenic approaches, particularly the BT, appear to be a major factor in achieving that.
Mm. Well, we have another caller here. Let's talk with them here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I share the same misgivings about using – you said it's very precise what you do in the lab. Well, I think there's the idea of unintended consequences when it gets out in the environment and without, you know, proper longitudinal studies of how this may affect things in the future. So I think one should approach it with caution. And I think there's sort of an economic imperative to go that way, and it's got to do with agribusiness's capture of perhaps research universities and just generally setting the agenda. It's much nicer to be able to sell something like that when doing the research on that. When if you really were interested in feeding more people, you might be considering looking into, you know, low-level agricultural credit and research at alternative technology levels that would actually do a lot more to really feed people, and as opposed to perhaps feeding someone's investment portfolio. Which, that reaches out to a broader argument. Actually, I wasn't planning on calling about that, but it came up just prior to my getting on. So, what I actually wanted to talk about was this whole argument about food versus fuel. Now, I've always been skeptical of the ethanol subsidy, but just as they're trying to phase it out, I've heard some arguments that say that it is a better prospect than people say. For one thing, when you look at this is perhaps too rudimentary, but when you look at the fact that they say, well, this much corn is diverted to ethanol, that's true, but you know that there's a factor in that the corn is fermented but the mash is still a food stuff, so it's not entirely diverted. In fact, there are some arguments to say it's a better food stuff for having less simple carbohydrates in it to some animals, or you know, and so it's a bit of a mirage to say that this much corn is diverted to ethanol. So that's a sort of a specific argument inside a broader general food versus fuel. Discourse. What do you have to react to either or both of those, I guess?
Well, I guess taking, you know, your first point, you know, where you sort of mentioned, you know, it's better to, for example, microbanks, means by which you can boost agriculture in sort of less developed parts of the world. I don't really see this as an either or. I think my view of this is that we need both of those things. Yes, we've got to improve the conventional ways of getting crop production up, in particularly in parts of Africa where average yields are still very low in many countries. So that definitely needs to be addressed. But of course, historically, the US has been a major buffer against famine in the world. We've really assumed this position almost over the last 150 years. We're one of the biggest exporters of staples. So from a world food security point of view, it's very important that the US does continue to increase its yields in the way that it has. So my argument there would be that we need both of these things. And I agree with your point on the precautionary principle, but just bear in mind that what we do in conventional breeding is putting many genes into plants, and we've been doing this for hundreds of years, where we have no idea what their function is, what the unintended consequences may be. So I would still say that the sort of engineering approach is actually a more precise way. We know exactly what change we've made. And there are, under current legislation, there are huge latitudinal test requirements, which is why really we have so few of these products on the market, because the expense means only the biggest companies in the world can even afford to consider this. On the corn ethanol issue, this is really a very complex topic. But certainly you're correct that, of course, the protein part of the grain, which is very substantial, the dried distillers grain, are a very valuable source of protein for animal feed. Will often substitute for soy in that respect and still give you the starch you need to then make the ethanol. I would, though, argue from our own research and our own institute that we do have other very important opportunities in this country of using land which is not suitable for food production to grow other plants that could be converted into biofuels. So I believe in the long term, we would have cheaper sources and would be able to use other land for that purpose.
I'm glad the caller raises this point, because this was something that I wanted to get to. It's maybe a little bit of a side issue, and yet it's certainly connected with this larger issue that we're talking about. And so maybe we could talk some more about it, because I think that there has been, over the past couple of years, where there have been concerns various places around the world about food shortages. Some people have made the argument that that's exacerbated by the use of food crops, things that people can eat, to take that and turn it into liquid transportation fuel. And some people raise questions about, for example, well, you know, do we want to be using corn to make something to put into our gas tanks when we could use it to make food? You've been involved in some research, and we've actually talked about it, taking a look at a perennial grass that is not something anybody's going to eat, so that's not a particular issue. It will grow on less desirable land under maybe less desirable conditions, and that I think that some people think that maybe the issue with biofuels is finding the right plant to use as your feedstock, that might actually make sense if, rather than corn, you use something like this plant, this miscanthus plant that you've been looking at.
Yes, we've over the last 10 years, we've looked very intensively now at miscanthus, which is actually a very close relative of sugarcane. But unlike sugarcane, it can grow right up to the Canadian border, and in fact, it's even being grown now in Canada. So we've set up trials of this crop around the country, looking at what yields could be achieved. And for example, a government has this Energy Independence and Sustainability Act, which the objective was to try and achieve 30% of our petroleum use within 30 years from biomass sources. Mm-hmm. So from the yields we obtained with miscanthus, we could achieve that goal with about 30 million acres. Now, That might sound a lot, but actually 30 million acres is about the amount we have at the present time in Conservation Reserve Program. It's probably only about 10% of the area we have in food and fiber crops nationally. And it's about the amount of land we've abandoned from agriculture over the last 50 years. Mm. So we certainly have that land resource in the US to do this without touching the land we need for corn, soy, and wheat production, for example.
And am I remembering right? Is this a perennial grass?
Yes. I mean, it has a number of advantages, really. Because it's perennial, it means that if you put it on more erodible land, it will actually bind the soil. So right. Unlike corn where we have to, you know, probably corn and soy where we have to till at least occasionally there, once this is planted, we never have to till that land again. We just harvest it in the fall after actually the crop has died, so it's moved its nutrients below ground. We then take the biomass off, convert that to a fuel. The nutrients stay below ground and then are used to grow the next year's above ground material. So this makes it quite low cost, but environmentally very beneficial as well.
And as I recall, it's actually not a very fussy plant. It doesn't really need a whole lot of care. It kind of just,
kind of just
does its thing.
Yeah. For example, in Illinois, on our southern soils generally produce far less corn than central and northern Illinois because the soil is just not as fertile. But actually Miscanthus gives us our highest yields in southern Illinois because it's got a little more heat, a little more water.
Yeah. Now, so, and also as I, it's been a while since I read anything about this, but I thought also that I recall, now this is a cellulose, so this was a cellulose ethanol, and that the manufacturing process would be different than for corn, and that still kind of has yet to be worked out how exactly you would do this.
Right? Yes, and this has been a major focus of our institute as to really getting to the most effective ways to do this. I mean, the technology's not completely new, as sometimes people think. In fact, Germany was actually doing this in the First World War. It used acid to dissolve the cellulose. Cellulose, like starch, is made up of sugar molecules. So what you have to do is break that cellulose down to release the sugar, and then you ferment it in exactly the same way as you ferment sugar from starch. Mm-hmm. But it's harder to achieve that. But many new technologies have now developed to address this problem, and we're now seeing the first commercial cellulosic ethanol plants.
So there actually are commercial level plants demonstrating how it can work.
Yes, and we're closely linked to one which is now being built in central Florida, which is going to be producing 60 million gallons of ethanol a year. So that's just started to be constructed. Mm-hmm. But
we're talking this morning, this hour of focus, with Professor Stephen Long. He is professor of crop sciences at University of Illinois. We're talking about the global food system and climate pressures on the global food system. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, zombies, crazed serial killers, blood, gore, mayhem, and unhappy endings. We talk with Jason Zinnemann, author of Shock Value, about modern horror films, which he says start with films like Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead. Also, Ray Romano talks about his critically acclaimed TNT series Men of a Certain Age. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with different topics every week. Tomorrow morning, both shows have to do one way or another with computers, or they're related to computers. In the first hour, the guest will be Eli Pariser. He's board president, former executive director of MoveOn.org. He's also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. We'll talk about a recent book that he's authored, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Then a more practical kind of approach to computer issues in the second hour. This is the show we do every month. We call Computers and You, so it's a chance to call in and ask questions. Maybe you have some kind of computer problem, that is with your own personal computer, and you need some advice. Celeste Quinn will be hosting the program, and her guest will be James Eyrick and Debbie Flieger. They've been before here on the program to answer questions. Whatever, you got a computer problem, we'll see if we can get you some help tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can check on the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs there by going to our web archive. In this hour of the show, our guest is Steve Long. He's professor in plant biology and crop sciences at the University of Illinois. And we're talking here, we started out talking about the issue of climate and what that, how that may or may not affect agricultural productivity, and how it is that people who are trying to breed very productive plants, produce very productive plants, are looking at dealing with issues like increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the fact that plants may have to put up with higher temperatures and more periods where they're not getting as much water as they would like, what that all means for agricultural productivity. And questions are indeed welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have some callers here. I don't want this to completely to turn into a show about ethanol, because that really wasn't what we set out talking about. There is something else another kind of research that you've been doing that I think is very interesting that I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about. And this indeed goes back to this to the issue of what's happening with the global climate and what that means for agriculture. And it has to do with increased levels of carbon dioxide and what that means for plants. Mm. Now, for people like me, for your layperson, I'm sure that people think, well, plants like carbon dioxide. That's why we get along so well with plants. they like carbon dioxide. They give off oxygen. We like that. So that works out pretty well. And there are some people who in the past, in looking at climate change, have said, well, if we have an increase in CO2, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Maybe that would actually mean plants would become more productive. Now, you've been doing some research on this here, trying to answer that question, and have come up with a different answer than people got in the past. And I think perhaps it has to do with how it is you're actually doing the work.
Yes. Well, taken in isolation, I mean, certainly you're correct that the plants do like carbon dioxide. And if we raise the carbon dioxide level, we generally get higher production from plants, if nothing else is changing. And greenhouse growers have actually exploited this. So tomato growers in particular will get a higher yield by raising carbon dioxide in the greenhouse. And in fact, this has been important in projecting what will happen in the future, because we know that rising temperatures, decreased water availability in the soil will probably lower yields. But we thought that would be offset by the fertilizer effect of rising carbon dioxide. However, all of these experiments were actually done in small chambers or in greenhouses. And probably as many of our listeners will know, plants in the field tend to respond very differently from plants in those protected environments. So what we set out to do together with engineers was to actually do the experiment in a farmer's field, raise the carbon dioxide level in the open air. And this is done by releasing carbon dioxide in a very precise way, according to wind speed and direction, and then continually monitoring and altering the injection of CO2. So by doing that, we were able to raise the carbon dioxide level in corn and soybean fields to the levels we were expecting for 2050. But what we found repeatedly with these experiments was that the yield increases we obtained were nowhere near as big as those that had been obtained in greenhouses and laboratory chambers. So this really meant that carbon dioxide, the boost in yield from carbon dioxide, would not offset the other negative factors from rising temperature.
Yeah.
Of course, there is another aspect to that. If you can get this in the greenhouse and you can't get it in the field, why is that? And if we can understand that, then we may be able to adapt our plants so that they do respond more in the field. We've worked with other groups in Australia and in Germany who've done the same type, and now China, who've done the same type of experiment with wheat and rice. And their results have been almost identical to ours.
Yeah. So this year, just what's really important, I think, for people to take away is this idea that before the work was done, if you do this work in a confined atmosphere kind of situation, you get these increases. You get increases in yield, and some people have said, well, maybe we got 20-30% increase in yield.
Yes.
But in the experiment that you've done, or what you're trying to do, it is more like real-world conditions. You do see some increases in production, but it's more like maybe 10%.
Yes.
And that then when you look at the what you think might be happening with yield with all these other things, particularly increases in temperature, then even if you get a 10% yield, it's not going to make up for the loss. It's not going to offset the loss from particularly from higher temperatures.
Yes, and it's certainly not going to be the bounty that we once thought it would be.
Well, just one other question, and I promise I get to callers here. We talked earlier about the kinds of things one can do with breeding with plants to try to make them more productive. And as I understand it, you can also try to breed plants for drought tolerance or to be okay with being flooded, you know. But one thing that seems like it's pretty resistant is tolerance for high temperatures. There's apparently you can't really quite do the same thing in engineering a plant so that it's fine if it's 100 degrees.
Yes, that's correct. As far as we know, that once we get up to, around about 110 degrees, then that's a leaf temperature. That appears to be lethal to most plants. The only ones which can resist that seem to be some desert cacti, which can go a bit higher. But even sorghum, which is probably grown in some of the sort of warmest parts of Africa, that appears to be a limit. Mm. And we have not found a way around that at present.
And I think even isn't it true that with corn and soybeans, that once you start to get into the upper 80s, it's not that that's going to kill the plant, but productivity really starts to fall.
Yes, even before we reach this lethal level, particularly pollination and grain set appear to be affected by those high temperatures. So we do not have much genetic variation there to play with in breeding.
Mm-hmm. And again, it seems that that's one of those things that there's just not, you could do all kinds of things, but getting a plant that would be able to thrive under those kind of heat levels, it sounds like it's probably not very likely you're going to be able to do that.
Well, yes, I mean, I think though, because this is so important, it's really an area where we do need to be conducting far more research into this heat stress issue, to really be able to understand where we might be in the future, and B, to understand if we have any options to overcome this.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a number of callers, and we're going now into about our last 10 or 12 minutes, so we'll get right back to the phones. And I do believe that the first person in line, I think, is Urbana line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I apologize, but I'd like to go back to miscanthus for a few minutes. I have two sets of questions. The first is, miscanthus, the ornamental varieties, have proven to be something of a problem in the south, in the east and southeast, where they've become invasive, quite aggressive invasive plants. How would you control this? I understand some of the strains of switchgrass and miscanthus are sterile hybrids. Also that there is a strain of miscanthus from Southeast Asia, apparently I suspect from a very high elevation, which demands such a long growing season it can't mature seed, although it is fertile. The other is, how do you break up a miscanthus sod after, if you should want to use the land for something else? friend of mine spent the better part of 2 weeks trying to break up a clump out at the Idea Garden using an assortment of tools, including, I believe, a chainsaw and grub hole. It is a very resistant plant.
Well, yes, of course, you can't have these benefits of binding the soil and putting a lot of carbon into it without having quite a considerable root and rhizome mass. On your first question, you're correct that Miscanthus is a very popular garden plant. You know, when I drive through Champaign-Urbana, I see it in just about every other garden I pass, and it has been for 100 years. And you're correct that certainly one or two strains have spread out of gardens. In North Carolina, there are areas where it appears to be invasive, one or two sites in New Jersey as well. And it does seem, as you go particularly to southern climates, that could be more of a problem. The one, though, that we're working with is an interspecific hybrid. So it's like, if you like, crossing a horse with a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
The result is completely sterile. This one, again, has been grown also in gardens because it's very tall as a backdrop for more than 100 years. Denmark and Britain have a lot of experience with it, and there's no evidence of that being invasive. Of course, the parent species, which are often used in horticulture, are the ones which do have the potential to be invasive. The seed is fluffy, it can be blown. And although we have, given that it's been planted everywhere, obviously it must only be a few lines which pose this risk, but you're correct that there is a risk there. So we would certainly say that if it's going to be used commercially, and of course it is being used commercially, that the sterile interspecific hybrid must be used, or alternatively, taking the approach that you were suggesting, that you basically grow lines where they simply do not get the day length they require to produce seed where you're actually growing them. So I agree those precautions need to be in place, and EPA has been examining this issue.
Will it grow on sands? There's a lot of land, particularly in Wisconsin, that really, without extensive irrigation, is unsuitable for most agricultural use. And it seems to me this land might work very well with a crop like Miscanthus.
Miscanthus possibly performs less well on sand when they're really almost pure sands. But we do have fairly long-standing trials now in Mason County on the sand soils there, where it has done quite well under rain-fed conditions. So, yes, it can be grown. The yield wouldn't be quite as good as on a clay soil, for example.
How long will a stand last commercially?
That's a very good question. And we really, in the U.S., we were the Illinois was the first university to even conduct trials with this crop, although we know it's been grown in gardens for many, many years. Denmark has probably been working with it now for 40 years. They have stands that they established 40 years ago, and they're still getting within 80% of the yield they had when they first planted it. So we think it could be two or three decades, possibly even longer. We know it occurs naturally in Japan, and we know there are areas there that have been harvested annually for possibly centuries.
And you essentially never have to apply commercial fertilizers because it moves the fertility below ground before you remove the crop.
Yes, that appears to be the case. Rothamsted, which is a very famous agricultural experimental station in the United Kingdom, has been growing a Miscanthus stand now for 17 years, and they've shown that adding nitrogen does nothing to the yield, basically, of that.
Well, it certainly has promise, and I wish you all kinds of success with it, and thanks for the information.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to another, I think this is another Urbana person, line one. Hello.
Hello. You were speaking of back to the water a and the CO2. I was trying to tie it together. I was on the H2O aspect of ethanol with corn and being six times as much water as producing a gallon of ethanol, if I'm correct in that understanding, which I think is a terribly significant feature. And I just wanted to bring in prairie, which is not so far away to compare with the prairie dock, for instance, which has 15-foot roots and is native to this area and doesn't have to be recreated, or maybe it does now since there's only 0.001% prairie in this county that was 96% prairie with such things not so long ago. So if we're doing research, I hope we're looking toward our own native plants here, including the forbs, not just the grasses.
Yes, on the university has a 340-acre energy farm, and that farm is dedicated entirely to looking at what we call second-generation bioenergy crops. So of course, the university is doing a great deal of research on corn and soy, but this is really looking beyond those at what else we might be able to grow. And we indeed have been looking at a number of prairie plants. We've also established a large area of prairie to look at how that compares. Unfortunately, why the prairie is certainly the most biodiverse, it's really quite expensive to maintain, and its yields are very much lower than growing something like miscanthus or switchgrass. One of our researchers at Illinois has actually shown that cordgrass, which is a native prairie plant, he's identified some native lines of that which look very promising, and we're testing those now, and we think that could compete with miscanthus, because for this industry, we don't want to be dependent on just one feedstock. We'd like to have a variety of potential feedstocks to give us diversity.
We've certainly been acquiring corn and soybean territory to the detriment of our prairie. And you mentioned cooperation with Australia. I think, I trust you know something about the Australian prairie monk who is amongst us and has done more in this area than anyone else in the whole university put together. He's been at it for 50 years right here under your nose, David Monk. I would love to see him as one of your consultants. He can help you a lot without having to start from scratch. He's been doing it since he came as a grad student 50 years ago.
Yes, well,
right here.
Yeah. Thank you for that advice.
Well, thank you. Let's go on here. We're getting short on time, and I have a couple of other callers I'd like to try to get in. So the next is in Pontiac, and that's line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. It's backing up a little bit, but about on the corn for ethanol, a lot of people feel we are taking away from the food supply by using ethanol, and the type of corn that's used is not the type that's used in the food chain, like cornflakes or flour or whatever. So I just like that point addressed.
Well, actually, of course, most of the U.S. corn is really grown for feed purposes, or at least originally it's suited as an animal feed.
Right.
So to some extent, of course, there is competition between corn ethanol an animal feed, and I think quite a lot of the meat industry, at least rightly or wrongly, blames corn ethanol for run up in prices of their, their feedstock.
But as previous caller pointed out, the mash that's left over is very high.
That's correct, and that really makes the situation rather more complicated.
Right.
And indeed, that is where most of it goes to animal feed, and cuts down on the amount of soy that's needed to provide protein in animal feed in many situations. But yes, so there's often a misconception that we're taking this corn away from human food, which of course is not the case, because most of it is not really suitable for much use in human food production.
I appreciate your comments.
All right, thank you. One more here, and this is Champagne, line number 3. Hello.
Hi, my concern is somewhat for the biodiversity versus monocrops, and this mention of prairie as an ecosystem. I'm feared that we're losing our genetic gene pool for 500 years down the line, and in terms of making energy right now or making other advantages, food. Even though an ecosystem like prairie is going to be much less profitable in terms of yield, is there some way of taking a total ecosystem with 110 broadleaves and half a dozen grasses and using that as a modest attempt to work with an existing gene pool so that it stays around? At the moment, there's very little of it left.
Well, I suppose there are two aspects to this. One is, of course, we wouldn't, you know, this wouldn't be replacing any of the remaining pristine prairie, which is really the only valuable sort of gene source we have left. I mean, if we, as we have, re-establish prairie, that, of course, is using seed, which is taken from those existing reservoirs anyway. So we're not really creating a gene pool as such by doing that. The other aspect, you know, unfortunately, and what we were testing is that the yields you obtain from these areas are just not economic for farmers and not close to them. So the only way you could then do this would be with massive federal subsidies, which don't seem likely in, you know, at any time in the near future. Another aspect to this really is, you know, another way of looking at this is the more productive you make land which has already, if you like, had its biodiversity destroyed because we've ploughed it, the more productive you make that land, the less pressure there is on the other areas. So my argument would be that that really we should make the most of the land we've, if you like, where we've already destroyed biodiversity. And by doing that, we take the pressure off of other less productive areas and allow those to be used for preservation purposes.
I must jump in here and say we're at the end and we're going to have to stop. We would try perhaps on another day to get back to some of these subjects again. But for the moment, we must end with our thanks to Steve Long. He's professor of crop sciences and plant biology and crop sciences here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.